Mr. Grimm.
Good morning. May it please the court, first of all, an apology for my voice. The effects of the allergy season have not completely left me, but I'll keep it up. I'm Terry Grimm. For certain interested parties who are appellants, certain defrauded investors who have been treated unfairly by the receiver below, and his report to the district court was unfortunately accepted. I contend as a matter of law that this circuit should say that it is wrong to treat equally defrauded investors unequally. Equity is a quality and vice versa.
Well, how about an example? Pick an example. So what would be a typical one of the people you're representing? He put in something initially, then he pulled out part of it, then he put it back. So tell us about one of these unfortunates.
Well, that's exactly the case with respect to some of them. Some of them put money in, then took it out.
Yeah, what would be, but more specifically.
How much money, you mean?
Yeah.
Over $2 million total for six
clients,
or seven of them.
Right. Give one of your clients. One of your an example, your client.
Well,
client.
Mr. Merrill, a member of the bar of this court, invested $950,000 and took out, I think, $450,000.
When?
The times of that I wouldn't know, Your Honor.
Well, that's
but he took it out before the fraud was exposed.
Oh, obviously. He took the $450,000 out. Then he put it back in?
Some of it back in. He had $950,000 in at one time.
Right. Took out $450,000 and put in how much? Put back how much?
Put back $500,000, I think. I can tell you exactly if I look at the...
Well, that's more than the $450,000. So he put back all of his $450,000 that he'd taken out and put back $500,000.
He lost a total of $450,000. He had $950,000 in, and he withdrew $500,000 before the fraud was uncovered.
He withdrew $500,000, and then he put back $450,000?
No. He had $950,000 invested. He took $500,000 back before the fraud was discovered, leaving him with $450,000. And $50,000 there when the fraud was uncovered.
But I thought these were people who took money out and then put it back in.
Some did, some didn't.
Well, I'm interested in the person who took it out. So give me an example of such a person, if you can think of one. If not...
Investor number three withdrew $332,000 and had on deposit $621,000.
He put in how much?
He put in $621,000.
$621,000, and he withdrew
$332,000.
And then he put back?
Well, I don't know whether he put back some more or not. He was just left with a $300,000 net loss when the fraud was uncovered.
But I thought that was the interesting part, where the people who, having pulled money out, then put some of it back. Were there people like that?
There were one or two like that, Your Honor. And I don't know that I made a big point of that or a point of that at all in my papers, but I can give you a few more, like Investor 108 withdrew $204,000 from a total deposit of $351,000. Leaving a $150,000 hole in her pocket when the fraud was uncovered. So what I'm trying to argue, and maybe I could quote from the decision, which I think helps us in this case, and that's the very well-done wealth management decision, in which the court said, distribution of assets on a pro rata basis ensures that investors with substantively similar claims to repayment receive proportionally equal distributions. And to me, that means, receiver, you go out there, you find all the money you can get, add it up, take off your fees, which the court approves, and then divide it up by the number of individual investors.
Now, and this money that people took out, did they take the, were these withdrawals or were these dividends that the Hubers were
No, they weren't dividends, Your Honor. You just had the right to withdraw, as I understand the facts of the case, and I only got in it a couple of weeks before the hearing on the fairness.
Had they been given representations as to how much their initial investment was worth when they started pulling out?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that every investor got books and records, pretty good accounts of what they had in and what they'd taken out, and they were limited, sort of like with these private equity funds. You could invest on a certain time, and 60 days later, you could make a withdrawal. So some did serendipitously, and some did not, and some withdrew, and some put it back in, and it led to the...
Yeah, but this 600, or say this fellow, he invested $351,000 and withdrew $204,000. Now, when he withdrew $204,000, did he think that he still had $351,000? Did he think that his $351,000 that he'd originally invested was still $351,000, or did he think it had grown?
I couldn't answer that question.
We don't have that? Okay.
I couldn't answer that question. But the question I can answer is the receiver purports to give a 41% return of net losses to 77 individual investors and nothing to 21 investors and less to 20 others. And it's right in his brief at page 9.
A typical example of someone who gets nothing.
Typical example of someone who gets nothing from the receiver now are the ones I just read.
So this person who had invested $351 and withdrew $204, leaving him with $147,000,
about right.
Okay, that person got nothing of his $147,000.
That's exactly right, and that's true of 20 investors.
And the theory under which he gets nothing is what?
The so-called rising tide method of distributing from a receiver's acquisition of purloined assets. Rising tide, I can't exactly tell you what it means, but it's time for this court to give it a good scrubbing with bleach.
Well,
it doesn't. Rising tide has
understand.
Never been squarely addressed by this court.
I don't understand the term either. But what did the receiver say was the reason why this person should get nothing, even though he'd lost 147?
Because the receiver has the misguided notion that the serendipitous withdrawal of funds before the fraud is uncovered means that that is a return of your money. And you got a partial return.
I see. So the notion is you got a partial return.
Right.
Other people got nothing, the ones who stayed in.
Right.
So now he gives them a partial return. And he says, your guys had their partial return.
That's exactly what he's saying.
Short of it, yeah.
That is exactly what he's saying. And I submit that's fundamentally unfair unless you have evidence that some of these investors knew something, you know, were tipped off, and they took the money out. But once the fraud is discovered, of course, then if somebody got some money, I agree, as with Judge Sykes' opinion in wealth management. If people got money after the fraud was discovered, that should be offset against their pro rata distribution. But other than that, everybody should get the same percentage of their net loss back. And the receiver could give 30% of the net loss to every individual, but he says, no, it's fairer if I give 41% of the net loss to the people who, unluckily, never asked for any money back before the fraud was uncovered. And I think that's unfair, and that should not be countenanced by this circuit.
But those people who never asked for any money back, they on average, presumably lose more, right?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily, but you'd think on average, someone who never withdrew would be worse fixed than someone who had withdrawn.
That is usually true. I went through those numbers, Your Honor, and
they all withdrew more than 50% of their initial investment. So
It is true, Your Honor, and I'm sorry I spoke over you, and I apologize. It is true that the largest single loser, poor fellow or the poor woman, I forget who it is, because they're not identified, you know, by names, just by numbers, lost $1 million. And then the next, who withdrew nothing, lost $750,000. But a number of them only lost $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. The attorney I spoke about, who's the named, one of the named appellants, he lost $450,000. So a lot of people lost a lot of money, and the only fair way to remedy it is to take the pot of money you have, which is $7 million, and distribute it proportionally by the same percentage of the net loss. That's the only correct way to look at it. The net loss is what everyone will tell you. That's what I lost. That's what I'm out. If you recovered 30% of the dough, good job. Give me 30% back. Otherwise, it's just serendipity. How do we know who really needed the money? How do we know who had cancer? How do we know whose father died, whose mother died? The receiver is looking at this at the wrong end of the horse.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Grimm. Time has expired. Mr. Durham?
If my time's expired, I ask you to reverse this case.
I'll give you more time. That's it.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ed Durham on behalf of the appellee, the receiver, Kevin Duff. Excuse me, I guess the allergies must be affecting me as well. Before getting the main part of my argument, I wanted to address some of the questions that were raised, and in particular this idea that people reinvested money. That is mentioned in the appellant's brief, but in fact there was really no record evidence of that. The receiver went through a painstaking process where each investor was given the amount of money they deposited, the amount of money they withdrew, and they were required to submit signed claim verification forms, either acknowledging they agreed or disagreed. Not a single investor disagreed with the way the receiver calculated
any reinvestment.
I think that would come down to a question of individual intent, which is something that goes beyond what this receiver could do in any type of cost-effective manner.
Well, but I don't understand. I mean, wasn't there anybody? I thought there were people who withdrew some and then put some of the withdrawn and then added more later.
There are examples of that, but that issue was not presented to the district court as a part of an objection, other than one investor, and it was Phil Bauer, who essentially said, "I put in $60,000, and then in a subsequent quarter, I put the $60,000 back in." And we raised that to the district court. We told the district court.
How was that treated by the receiver?
We treated that in the same way as every other investor. Essentially, the only way the investor can do this in a cost-effective manner is to come up with a bright-line rule.
Well,
and the bright-line rule was...
So in that case, he withdraws 60 and he then invests 60. Suppose he started with 100, he withdraws 60, he then reinvests the 60. So as a result, he's lost his original 100,000. So what does he get in the way of a percentage? Is he treated as having recouped 60 of the 100?
If he put it
in
the example that was used, I believe, in their brief, which is a hypothetical, investor puts in 100, takes out 50, and then later puts 50 back in. Under their scenario, they say that's really only a $100 deposit because they simply were putting the $50 back. Under the receiver's calculation, yeah, it's $150 of deposits, the $100 and the $50 minus the $50 withdrawal, and the percentage of recovery was 33%. The problem is that this was just simply not an issue that was presented.
I'm lost. Puts in 100, he withdraws 50, puts the 50 back. As a result, he's lost $100,000. Now, is he treated like these people who withdrew, or is he treated like someone who never
withdrew? Treated the same as every other investor that withdrew, and there's two problems.
He's treated as a withdrawer, even right. though he put the money back later.
But you're assuming that he's putting the money back later is merely a reinvestment. We have a 10-year Ponzi scheme where we have people who put money in year one. They put $100 in year one, they take $150 out in year five, and in year 10 they put back in $100. We're making an assumption that they're reinvesting. If you're going to go down that line, you have to go essentially do evidentiary hearings.
I don't care whether it's reinvestment. I'm just wondering whether that's treated as a loss of 100 or a loss of 50.
It's a loss of 100. Either way, it's the same loss.
But he's not treated the same people the same way as a person who put in 100 and never took anything out, right?
He's treated differently in the sense that the receiver calculated that the investor received back 33% of their of the money they would they deposited into the Ponzi scheme. The problem here is that
so invests 100. He invests a total of 100 and I'm getting lost. He invests 100. Withdraws 50, puts back the 50. So although he's lost 100, he's credited with having what received 50 or
what? No, he puts in 100, he takes out 50, and then later he puts 50 back in. That the total money in minus total money out. That is the way every equitable receivership operates. If you look at
So he gets 33%, you're saying?
The assumption is that he got the return of 33%.
Now, if he just put in the 100 and never withdrew anything, what would he get?
It would be the assumption is that he got 0% out, and so he will get his pro rata distribution.
So he'd get 47%?
No, he'll get, in this case, it's a 41%.
41%, okay, but the point is the person the person who returns the amount that he's withdrawn, he gets a smaller percentage of the receiver's assets.
That is correct. The problem is this just...
What is the rationale for doing that?
This wasn't an issue before the district court.
What is the rationale for doing that?
The rationale is that otherwise the receiver has to go back and do individualized hearings on every investor to determine whether when they are putting money back in following a withdrawal, whether they're reinvesting or intending to put in new money into the Ponzi scheme. There's issues of timing.
What difference does it make whether they're reinvesting or putting fresh money in?
Because essentially every time they withdraw money, they're not withdrawing their own money. They're withdrawing the commingled funds of all the other investors. They're essentially withdrawing stolen funds. So if 5 years later they decide to put in new money, they're not putting back in that same money. They're putting in fresh money into the Ponzi scheme.
What difference does it make?
The difference is simply that they had an opportunity to get money out, and they were and the fact
everybody
that they chose,
had an opportunity to get money out.
Right. But the fundamental assumption underlying the rising tide is that you have to take into account. And if you, for example, if you look,
I don't understand it. I don't know what's the sense of it. What's the difference between someone who leaves the someone who has $150,000 and he takes $50,000 out, so he loses $100,000. Well, forget about the reinvestment. And you compare that with a person who had If a person has $150,000, takes $50,000 out, loses $100,000. Now compare him with a person who put in $100,000, took nothing out. So he's lost $100,000. They've both lost the identical amount. Why shouldn't they get the identical percentage of the receiver's assets?
Because the person who received the $50,000 out received it from other investors. The assumption underlying the net loss is that people are withdrawing during the Ponzi scheme, they're getting their own dollars back. And that is the fundamental issue.
Are you saying that this fellow who withdrew the $50,000 made the other people worse off because he was depleting the...
Absolutely. The other people are funding the Ponzi scheme. In other words, if you look at this case, there were 55%, 64 of the people put $11 million in the Ponzi scheme, got back zero. The class of 21 that are getting nothing collectively got back 62%. And there is no record evidence that of that 62%, it was a reinvestment. That is an argument which has been invented on appeal. It was not raised below. and I don't think it's a legitimate basis to go into
what is what's the significance of reinvestment? I don't understand. What difference does it make where the money
I don't think it does. I don't think it does. But the point is that essentially what has happened is that, and there may be cases, it's a case-by-case basis. Let's say that there's a situation where there's a 15% distribution, and I believe it's one of the cases, and basically there are 70 investors, and if you apply the rising tide, 55 would get nothing, and I believe this is the Barkey case that I'm talking about. Presumably that means that you have a whole bunch of investors that are grouped around that 15% line. In that case, it doesn't make sense to apply the rising tide. However, in a case like this, where you have the majority of people who got nothing, they essentially funded the Ponzi scheme. They allowed the Ponzi scheme to continue. And every time money was paid out to the people that got back, and the 21 people got out between 44 and 98%. So if you applied the rising tide, you would essentially say, you who got 80%, you who got 98%, you should get more money. You should be able to get 99.5% return on your money before the person who took out nothing gets their money. And that's just not right. And that is why the court was well within its discretion to approve a plan which took into account withdrawals.
Let me just ask one more question. Is this how the Madoff business has been handled?
I believe it is. It is the same way, but I haven't investigated that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Durham.
Thank you.
Time it expired, but you can have a little extra time if you want.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Please have another look at Judge Sykes' decision in wealth management. You'll find out that that well-reasoned case makes us win. Do not allow this rising tide, I'm not going to call it a fraud, but it is silly. Do not allow a receiver to be sustained in your court when he could give 30% of everyone's net loss back. And he's not doing that
but
to 41 investors.
Counsel, the people who withdrew money before the collapse of the Ponzi scheme fortuitously cut their losses at the expense of the other investors. I think that's the rationale behind this method of distribution. And why is that not a sound rationale?
It's not a sound rationale, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the net loss for everyone.
No, I understand. It's a different way of evaluating
it's
the distribution.
Rationale.
It's not a net loss valuation. That's what you're arguing for. But it's got a rational basis. It's a sound method of achieving the equality principle. It's just one that disfavors your clients. Well, but well, it protects the investors who did not fortuitously cut their losses. You better stay by the microphone.
Your Honor, I like your wealth management decision. I can't tell you what you meant.
You said that many times,
affirming this receiver does damage to the wealth management decision. You should reverse the receiver. There's still $1 million left. All the horses aren't out of the barn, and that should be distributed to the 41 people that I'm standing up here arguing for. Thanks, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Grimm and Mr. Durham.